You're listening to
Potluck. Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yuen.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we are bringing you an author chat with Sophie Wan about her debut novel, The Women of Good Fortune, out now at booksellers everywhere. As always, the Books and Boba podcast is supported by our listeners at patreon.com/booksandboba. So if you'd like to help support what we do here on the podcast, head on over and become a member. Our members gain access to our members-only Discord server as well as monthly bonus podcast episodes. But yeah, we had a really great chat with Sophie. I remember we were really excited when we learned about her book way back when it was first announced. The story is about three Chinese women living in modern day Shanghai, who in the eyes of Chinese society are considered leftover women, and each of them are chafing from living under a patriarchy. And so they decide to fight back by planning a heist and stealing the red envelope money from the wedding of one of their members who is marrying into a rich family. So yeah, just a great premise, right?
Yeah, It sounded super fun from the pitch. So I love talking with Sophie about like how she came up with the heist. And also, you guys, like regular listeners will know how much I hate the patriarchy. So we did talk about that as well.
Yeah, it was definitely in addition to a great heist story, one that offers a really nuanced exploration of, you know, the way that patriarchy really screws everyone up. So yeah, please enjoy our conversation with Sophie Wan.
And we're here with Sophie Wan, the author of Women of Good Fortune. Welcome to our show, Sophie.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
Now, I'm looking at your bio, and it says that you're a graduate of UC Berkeley and spent too long writing emails before she picked up writing fiction. So my question is, was writing always something that you wanted to do and you finally got around to doing it in college, or was it something that you found to be a passion later?
Yeah, I always really enjoyed writing. I started doing it when I was 11 years old, and I was reading these books and thinking, oh, I wish the ending was different. And then I decided to go off and kind of write my own endings for things. And then from there, started thinking, oh, maybe I should like try writing stories of my own. So that was where it really got started. And I've always been a voracious reader. So I feel like I've always been inspired by authors and like really amazing books out there. But when I was in college, I think I actually started doing it less because it was very much a really intense time of trying to get a job and my parents giving me a lot of pressure of, you know, you need to go do something stable so that you can support yourself. And I actually did want to minor in creative writing when I was in college, but I applied for a number of creative writing classes at Berkeley, and I actually didn't get into any of them. So to me, I thought that meant that I wasn't actually good enough at writing. And so I kind of set it aside as, you know, something that maybe I would come back to one day, but it just wasn't a top priority. And then after I graduated, I was really busy with work, kind of like getting used to being a functioning adult. So I didn't do a lot of writing then either. But during COVID, I think that was when I was at home and I had a lot more time. And I thought, hey, maybe I should try to go back and actually try to finish something, because I think that is the main thing that I struggled with when I was writing when I was younger. It was that I would have all these ideas and I would go off and I would write a couple pages or maybe even like a third or half of a book. And then I'd kind of just give up and or some other idea would come by and I'd be like, oh, this is a way better idea. And so I would never finish anything. And so I told myself, you know, this time, no matter what, I'm going to try to finish something, even if it's really bad. And I think that's when I realized how much fun it is to write. And it was just like, it gave me a lot of energy and inspiration during a time when there wasn't a lot of great stuff going on. And I think that was when I started actually seriously thinking about traditional publishing and doing research to find out what that actually meant. And so I think like I started seriously getting back into writing around 2020. And then I was writing Women of Good Fortune in 2021. And then it sold in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I mean, writing like a 5-page essay is hard enough for me. I can't imagine writing like a 350-page novel.
Oh, 5 pages, Marvin? Oh my God. My regular essays were like 10 pages. That's absolutely nothing. But as someone who has like written like 100K words for writing projects and like never finished it, I like totally understand like the fear of actually like never being able to finish something. So credit to you, for real.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's just really easy to get dismayed, especially in the middle. And I still struggle with this anytime I write something where I'm just like, I kind of lose the plot and I'm like, I don't know where I am anymore. And it's really easy at that point to think about just like going to the new shiny idea. But I think finishing the very first manuscript that I did kind of gave me the belief in myself that I would be able to find my way to the end.
Yeah. So I'm curious to hear about what happens next. So you finish your book and you're starting to query it. How did you go about learning how to, you know, get your book published, like getting an agent, finding a publisher? Like how much of it was luck and how much of it was like going with a plan? Like what was your process like?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, traditional publishing scared me for so long. Like I remember how much weight I kind of gave the whole querying process because it seemed to me like this big, inaccessible thing that only like authors had figured out. And I think like doing the research helped, but I think also doing it in isolation helped a lot. So I think back when I was querying, I wasn't really part of Twitter or X. I wasn't that plugged into what people were talking about in the book community. And I think that helped a lot because then I didn't get discouraged by seeing all the posts out there and having a benchmark. I was kind of just going at things at my own pace. So I think that helped a lot. I think, yes, like a lot of the research that I did was I would Google things online. There was this Reddit, there's a subreddit called Pub Tips that I used a lot. Like that's where I got my query critiqued. And I also read a lot of query letters that other successful authors had shared on their blogs. And I think that gave me a good idea for how to structure my query writing. And then I remember I was so scared when I sent out my first query. And then like when I got my first rejection, which was I think within like a day, I was like, oh my gosh. It's out there now. It got rejected. I'm seriously doing this thing. So I think, I mean, I do think it's like a lot of luck. I think I was very lucky that my agent was the one, like I chose my agent, that they picked it up and connected with the query that I sent, and that they decided to make the offer to represent me. Like, I feel like there's so many factors in play, like whose inboxes are open? What are they looking for at that time? Is there like a comp that's come out that's gotten everyone excited? So I think all of those things definitely combine together to help me query then. Like, I don't even know what my success would look like these days.
Yeah. Okay. It's time for our most basic question here on Books and Boba, because you did mention that your parents wanted a stable life for you, which is, you know, a common thing for a lot of us children of immigrants. When you were writing this book, when you were going about your querying journey, like, did they know? Like, when did you tell your parents that you had written and published a book?
I didn't tell them until I did tell them I got an agent, but I don't think they really understood what that meant. And I think even when the book sold, I told them I like sold the book. I think that was when it kind of hit for them. Like before that, they always knew that I liked to write. Like they had known that I wanted to study writing in college, but to them it was always like, oh yeah, it's a nice hobby for you to have. You can do it while you're working if you have time. And it wasn't until I told them that the book sold and I told them, oh yeah, like it sold to HarperCollins, that I think they got it. And the reason that I know that they got it at that point was that my mom said she had just finished reading Simu Liu's biography. And she was like, oh, now I understand how his parents felt when he got the Marvel role. And I was like, okay, they get it now.
Wow. That's amazing.
All right. So for our listeners who don't know much about your book, can you give them a short rundown? I know that this book has been pitched as Crazy Rich Asians meets Ocean's 8, which is already like, it sounds so entertaining. So
yeah,
can just give us a short.
When we read the Publishers Weekly announcement of this book, we were like, we must read this. It's already like a must read.
<I'm> so glad. Yeah. So Women of Good Fortune, it's a contemporary fiction novel, and it's about these three women kind of led by this reluctant bride-to-be Lulu. She gets proposed to by a man who is, by all purposes, he's wealthy, he's attractive, he comes from a good background, but she just isn't in love with him and she doesn't want to get married. And from there, she hatches this plot with her two best friends, Jane and Rena, who have their own desires and motives their own motives. And they decide to do a heist to steal the red envelopes of gift money from Lulu's wedding, because they know that it's going to be a huge wedding, lots of really important, really rich people attending. And so the wedding gifts that they're going to give are probably going to give the three of them enough money to do the things that they really want to do. And so from there, lots of hijinks ensue. And obviously there's plenty of obstacles that come into the picture that make them question whether this is the right choice to make.
Yeah. I mean, like we mentioned, once we heard the synopsis of your story, we were already all the way in. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we already kind of knew the implications of what it means to steal, you know, red envelope money from a wedding. How did you come up with this concept as the basis of your heist?
Yeah, I think a lot of it came from some conversations I was having with a friend of mine. He attended a wedding and told me that the red envelopes were being collected in a glass safe. And that really got me thinking about why a safe? Who is the money being protected from? And what if someone were to actually try to steal those envelopes? And I think in our conversations together, he was like, oh yeah, you could do something like Wedding Crashers and have like this guy going around and stealing envelopes. And I was like, no, 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 it has to be women. And then that's when I started thinking about, I was really interested in the topic of the Shengnu in China. And I had been doing a lot of like reading and watching videos about it and just the experience of women who have that label on them and feel that intense pressure to get married. And so I really wanted to incorporate that somehow. And so that's where I came up with the idea of, okay, what about these three women who kind of fall into that category, but that's not the thing that defines them. There's so much more to them than that. And can we explore that while having this fun backdrop or momentum of this heist that they're planning together?
I will say, as someone who did have a wedding reception last year, handling we didn't have a safe, but we did have a glass box where people would stick their envelopes in, and figuring out how to handle that, who's in charge of that, was kind of a stress point, because, you know, you're having weddings in like public areas or like, who knows,
yeah,
who can walk past this thing. And we weren't bringing in like millions of dollars like the characters in your book, but it was a substantial amount of money because, like, I don't know if it's the same way in Korean culture, Rira, but in Chinese culture, events like weddings and graduations are a time for families to settle their debts to each other. And so, like, they give money to the next generation as a sneaky way to pay back, like, the parents for money they received earlier.
I don't think we're that over the top when it comes to paying, like favors and just like our weddings are so fast. Like it is like you take like maybe half a day off from work to go to a wedding and it is done within like 3 hours. It is very efficient because Koreans are very impatient. So reading a lot about like the Chinese wedding traditions, even as like an Asian person, I'm like, whoa, this is very intense. And the in-laws are very intense. And I've seen some like real wedding dramas in just like white people culture, like in American culture. And I was just like, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can deal with being the bride of a Chinese wedding. It just sounds like so much pressure. But I wanted to ask, like, how did you go about planning the heist? Like, were there any logistical problems you struggled with to answer? Because heists are very, like, that is a very ambitious genre to write as your debut novel.
Yeah, tell me about it. So it's really funny because in the earliest version of the book, I was also a little intimidated by the idea of writing a heist. So I kind of like skimmed over the portion of the heist where I was like, oh yeah, like they have to steal the money, something's happened, oh, okay, they stole it or they didn't steal it. And my agent saw that draft and was like, no, I think you need to add some more detail to this part. And I was like, oh no. And basically what I did is I did a bunch of research by watching heist movies. Like I was taking notes on them and I was basically like, okay, here's the crew. Here's what everyone does on the day of. What are the obstacles that come up and like, what's the timing around those things to help with the drama of the plot? And I think that helped me a lot because I kind of realized from doing that is that a heist is like a lot of tiny little things. And so even when a tiny little thing goes wrong, then it can throw the whole thing off. But that means that, you know, it could be something as small as she wasn't there. She wasn't at a certain meeting point when she was supposed to be. And then suddenly, like, you can take the plot in a whole different direction. So I think that helped a lot with conceptualizing what needed to happen. And then after that, I basically outlined the entire day of the wedding in a day, like starting from when they all show up. And then I had the spreadsheet with all the characters and where they would be and what time it was in the day. And that helped me keep track of what everyone was doing. And then like the actual writing of the heist, I basically wrote it in one day because I was so scared that I would just forget small details if I went to sleep. So I did all of that through the course of one day. And then even after that, like, I still had lots of editing I had to do with my editor and with my agent. Like, for example, the placement of the safe got really complicated. It was like, oh, like, is it always in the wedding venue? Are they moving it somewhere? Where, how are they going to get it out if there's all these people around? So that was quite a headache. But I think with all of us working together, we managed to get it to where it needed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's because you wrote it on one day, but that intensity definitely came through during the heist chapters.
I thought it was such fortunate timing on your part, because Portrait of a Thief came out in 2022, and then you have Dial A for Aunties by Jesse Q Sutanto, which is kind of a heist, but it's more like hiding a body. So I guess it's kind of, yeah. I mean, they have a plan and it's wacky and whatnot. So that came out in 2021. So as someone who is like writing during quarantine, like, how did that feel seeing books that like could be shared in the same category in terms of like subgenre.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was, I mean, it was really encouraging. And I know Grace, her blurb is on the cover of my book. And she was actually so helpful, even in the beginning, when I was actually starting to think about this, I was starting to think about writing this book. I actually reached out to her and was like, do you have any tips for writing good heists? And she was kind enough to help me. And I think it's just amazing to see the kinds of like AAPI focused books out there. Like there's not only the literary books that really dive into, you know, the diaspora and growing up Asian in America, but I think it's really awesome that there's also these sorts of books with like an element of like crime and like doing bad things and also having a lot of fun. And so I thought it was really exciting to see these books out. And I think it also made the job easier for me because I could say like, hey, this book is kind of going to be like Dial A for Aunties, and look how well that did. So I'm always really excited when I see like other Asian authors writing books that are kind of similar or like in a genre that I would like to write in the future.
You guys should definitely do a panel together for like your book tour. I can just like sense that it would be such a fun panel to listen to.
Oh, that would be so much fun.
Yeah. Okay, so your three main characters in your book, Lulu, Jane, and Rena, they all represent, let's say, like three archetypes on how like patriarchy and specifically Chinese patriarchy has failed and is failing, you know, women in society. Can you tell us how you developed your characters? Like, did the archetypes come first or, yeah, how did you develop your characters?
I do think the archetypes came first. I wanted to write first about, initially to write about women who were around like their late 20s, early 30s, because I think that's a really confusing time when you're really figuring out what you want in life, but you're also confident enough because you have kind of grown and learned to know like there's some things that you're not going to settle for. So that was kind of where I started. And then I knew that each of them, there was something that they really, really wanted. And so for Jane, that's beauty. For Rena, it's time. And for Lulu, it's freedom. And I think those are the top like themes that I crafted their characters around. And I think in the process of doing the research and thinking about, you know, pulling elements from both Western and Eastern culture, I think I definitely wanted to focus on like the family dynamics and also what is the result of like family pressure. And I think you can see that happening in different ways across the three of them. So I think like after I moved from like, okay, what do the three of them want? Then I sort of thought about it across the dimensions of like family, relationships, upbringing, and then fleshing out each of their stories according to those dimensions.
Yeah, like what I really appreciated about the friendship that they all had, I mean, they're all so different. They're all living different lifestyles. And even though there's like some jealousy involved, such as like Jane wanting like Lulu's access to wealth and like pretty privilege, the girls are like very supportive of each other. But at the same time, they have that struggle of maintaining an adult friendship where, you know, it's just like everybody is kind of growing in their own way, but that creates tension. And I just like want to ask, like, how did you go about developing like the dynamics between the girls? Because Lulu and Jane have a different relationship as opposed to like Rena and Jane.
There's actually this document that my editor sent me during the revision process that was like, make sure to think about these relationships. And it was basically every single permutation of relationship in the book. So it was like Rena and Jane, Rena and Lulu, Rena and her mom, Lulu.
Wow, how thorough.
Yeah, I was like, oh my goodness. But I think that helped a lot with like really becoming like coming up with like tangible examples of how these characters would interact with each other. And I think what also helped was when I was doing my revisions, so I wrote everything kind of like chronologically. And when I did my revisions, I would just do each reading from one specific character's point of view. And I think that helped me a lot with figuring out their voice and also with teasing out the nuances in their interactions with everyone else. So I think that was a big thing when it came to fleshing it out and also making sure that everyone's relationship was different. Like, you know that Rena's not going to treat Jane the same way that she does to Lulu, and like the way that they also perceive one another. So I think like that's a lot of the stuff that came in during revisions of just like honing in on each individual sentence and thinking about what opportunities exist in each scene to make it really clear what these characters think of each other and how they would interact.
Yeah. How was it in the editing process, like getting the concept of like senyu, like leftover women across? Because it's a concept that is, I don't think uniquely Chinese, but like it's definitely like very prevalent in Chinese society. Like, I don't know if you are aware, Rira, in Shanghai, there is an actual physical marriage market. There's a place where go to the park.
No, I've watched documentaries. I've seen the umbrellas.
Yeah, and it's basically like none of the children are there. It's just parents making deals with each other to like marry off their kids. And you look at the boards and you're like, this woman is like 27 years old. Like, it's like parents really do freak out once you get past 25, you're not married yet, right? And how was exploring that in your book?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was most interested in. And so I really enjoyed doing the research that came with, like, I watched documentaries about what it was like being a woman who was considered leftover. And I also know people who would have fallen into this category. And I think it's just like, it's really interesting to me because these are women who are so successful. Like, they've gone off, they have created lives for themselves. They're supporting themselves fine. They can afford to do the things that they want. And yet all of their value ends up getting narrowed down to who are you going to marry? Like, why aren't you dating anyone yet? And I think a lot, like, there's so much of that pressure that comes from the direction of people's families. Like, I remember watching a documentary where this one woman goes back home to visit her family. And they're just like, I think she like shares that like she had some good news at like her job, but they're just like, well, why aren't you dating anyone yet? Like, maybe you should get married soon. And so I think that's like such an interesting area to explore. And also, I think what I am hoping the book does a little bit is to destigmatize that. Like, it doesn't matter what age you are, you can choose not to get married. And I think there's just like so many things more like, people make all their own choices, and there are so many other things that you could have to have a fuller life that don't have to be romantic love. So I think that was kind of the train of thought that I was going on when I decided to start exploring this topic, to like basically empower people or empower women to, you know, not feel the pressure to have to attach so much of yourself worth to whether you're in a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to see, I guess, like the feminist movement in East Asia, particularly in like China and Korea, because like, I don't know if China has like their own version of this, but there's a 4B movement in Korea. And it's where women are like, fuck around and find out, because they're so sick of the patriarchy, and they've just like become determined to like not marry, not have kids, to not just date, because they're like, you're not treating us the way that we deserve. So like, have you learned any like any cool things about like Shengnu and how they're combating like societal expectations and family expectations?
Yeah, there was actually, I've been seeing a lot of videos recently. So I watch Xiaohongshu, which is the Chinese version of like, it's like TikTok and Instagram and all these things in one. And I've been seeing a lot of videos of that are vlogs from women that are like, what it's like living alone as a 35-year-old or as a 40-year-old or something. And it looks pretty awesome. They're like just doing their own thing. They have all these fancy gadgets and they cook these dinners and watch dramas while they're eating their ramen. So I feel like there's definitely kind of a surge in like against this, where a lot of women are saying like, hey, look at me, I'm by myself and my life is possibly better than those of married people.
And like society has conditioned women, whether you're Asian or you live in a Western country, to kind of equal your self-worth with appearance, how attractive you can be. And I feel like there's this habit that a lot of cis women have, which is like where they objectify themselves from an outsider's perspective. So there's a lot of like body dysmorphia and just a lot of like low self-esteem.
I know, that's the hard part, I think, of being a woman. It's that we've always been conditioned to know that beyond how we see ourselves, we're also hyper aware of how we might be perceived by other people. And I think that's what creates so much of this tension and this like, and like the struggle with like body and self-acceptance.
Yeah, it definitely goes back to just the fact that like the value of a daughter, a woman in Chinese society hasn't really evolved. I mean, it has evolved, but you still see the traces of, you know, those traditions of male and son preference over daughters that has persisted as a form of like generational gender trauma. And your book does a really good job exploring how that affects, you know, modern families as well. You know, something that Rira and I were talking about in our Discord while reading your book was just how terrible some of the parents were in your book. like lots of toxicity, both from a class aspect and from a, like a gender aspect. Like when you write these caricatures of terrible parents and the things they say, like, is that fun or is that like frustrating for you too as you're writing it?
First off, Marvin, I don't think that they're caricatures because I have legit met people like that.
Yeah, I think those kinds of parents do exist. And in response to your question, I did find it kind of liberating to be able to write this kind of thing and like bring a lot of what I've observed onto the page. So I think that was, yeah, like I actually really enjoyed that experience of kind of exploring how different characters had different relationships with their parents and how like basically you can tie back a lot of the way that they behave and how they see themselves to how their parents treat them. So that was actually such a interesting process when it came to like plumbing the character development. And I feel like that was something also during revisions that I was surprised by how much everything kind of tied together when like I was considering, okay, why is Jane like this? And then, oh, like, it's because her mom says these things to her or treats her in this way. So yeah, I think those kinds of parents definitely exist, but obviously like there's also really great parents. My parents, despite the pressure they've given me, are very, very supportive. And I think like that complexity is also really important too, that a lot of the times the way that parents treat their children is, I mean, it's like their way of showing their love for them, even though sometimes it may get a little too much.
Yeah, I feel like filial piety and also gender norms, it's so ingrained in our culture and it can just be a breeding ground for a lot of emotional abuse and emotional manipulation in extreme cases. Because like we said, like, there are very supportive parents out there who show their love because who show their love by being strict because they want the best for you. But there's also parents who kind of see their children as extensions of themselves. And it, the love is kind of rooted in narcissism. It's always about like how my child is going to reflect on me. And it's like recently I listened to this podcast where it was with an Indian American host, and he was talking with his mom about boundaries, and she just hated that word. She was just like, boundaries, that does not, just like that
they don't exist.
Like, what do you mean boundaries? Yeah. And she was just like, it doesn't exist in our culture. Like, you should respect your elders and whatnot. So it just got me thinking, like, do you think boundaries exist in Asian culture? Like, do you think that it is possible to set up boundaries in our generation with our parents without going against like traditions, I guess?
I definitely think so. Like, I think there are areas of like of how you behave with your parents that I think have to change, especially in the time that we live in. And also, I think I'm like thinking about this from like a US point of view. Like, for example, in China, I think a lot of, and in like a lot of parts of Asia, Europe, and other parts of the world, like, even after you graduate college and start working, a lot of times, like, the child will stay at home and, like, they'll still keep living at home until, like, I guess, like, they make enough money to, like, or to get married or buy a house. And I think, and then, like, comparing that to my experience growing up in the US, my parents were like, no, you need to get out and, like, figure out your own life. So I think there needs to be a double-sided, like, I think the child needs to be willing to have that conversation with their parents and say, I know that this is what you're used to, but this is how, like, this is how I'd like to be able to explore my life and adulthood. And then I think the parents on their end, like, they need to listen and be open to that. And I think there's like, that's where like a lot of the difficulty comes from, right? Like, when the communication is really difficult, like, I think in a lot of Asian cultures, even like saying I love you is so hard. And I think getting over that, like those communication barriers and being open with each other is such an important part of culture. And I feel like it is happening more. I feel like a lot of people that I know, a lot of Asian Americans I know, are saying like, oh, like, I try to tell my parents I love them more and get them to say it back to me. Or like, I try to like talk to them about like what's happening. And so I think breaking down those boundaries, I guess, is like what helps with like being open to change.
Yeah. I mean, the parents definitely have to be more receptive to listening to their children, in my personal opinion and personal experience, because a lot of the times it's just like you voice your opinion and they say, don't talk back to me. Why do you have like such an attitude? And I'm like, I don't have an attitude. I'm literally just communicating what I need, but I need to be met on, like, you need to meet me halfway. And I feel like the communication part is just so hard because people are not willing to listen to the other party and meet them halfway. So got a lot of war flashbacks reading your book, for sure. But like most of your characters, they studied at like these elite colleges in the States, like Stanford, and they returned to China after graduation, whether it's to like pick up the family business or because they're going to like take care of their family member who is sick. And I'm sure there is like a reverse culture shock that they go through. So can you expand more on that? And have you experienced it yourself when you go visit your family in China?
I think for the characters, I guess you particularly see this with Rina in the book, because she actually goes to the US when she's younger, compared to Jane and Lulu. And she gets, used to life there, but then she ends up returning to China for work. And I think the biggest culture shock there is just how different work life is in Asia versus the US. And I will say, like, I mean, this is just like one instance, but there are probably, like, it's not meant to be a catch-all of like the difference between work life in the US and Asia. But in her situation, there's basically no work-life balance when she returns to China, which is why she feels even more of that pressure of time. And I think there's also more of that implicit sexism where, you know, where her boss is like, well, if you're going to have kids soon, then maybe you shouldn't like keep working here, or like basically feeling like whether the time that you decide to get married and have children is going to have a huge impact on whether you can even keep a job and whether you can get hired after. And I think like that still exists too. Like that definitely still exists in the US. But it like maybe a little bit like more insidious.
Like we like, have actual laws that
yeah,
you
there's
know,
like
protect
law,
us.
And nobody's going to like warn you and say like, hey, maybe you should not get pregnant. So I think that's like, that's probably like the biggest piece. And then also like the 996, which I mentioned in the book, which is this expectation that you're like working like 6 days of the week from 9 until 9. Oof. And then what was your other question? Did you have another question?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the second part is like, did you experience like reverse culture shock whenever you visited family in China?
Yes. I actually went back to China this past year. And I think there's definitely a lot of things that are different about it. First of all, I can't really read or write Chinese. Like I'm basically illiterate. And going back to China, it's very frustrating to look at signs and like be able to sometimes pinpoint some characters, but not know what the entire thing is saying. And like the biggest struggle is ordering off of a menu because I can't read anything on the menu and there's no pictures a lot of times. So I just have to like point and like hope for the best. So I think like that's one of the things. I think also like a lot of things in China also are run like very, it feels like very efficiently too. Like there's really good public transportation and in like cities like Shanghai, it's generally like very clean. And like, I think, and it feels very safe. So I think like those are some of the things that I noticed. I will say though, it feels very safe because there's like surveillance everywhere. Like that's something that you have to get used to too. But overall, I think when I go back to China, I still feel like I'm going home, like being with my relatives and being surrounded by Mandarin all the time. It's like a very different feeling from being in the US. Like it still feels very near and dear to my heart.
Okay, so we've talked about your three main characters, but we all know a heist, you need at least five people to pull off successfully. And so you have two other characters that you bring in. Obviously, you need someone to create fake goods. So you have a counterfeiter and you also need a driver. So you have like a younger, Rina's younger cousin, May. I thought it was really cool that you also explored these aspects of like Chinese culture, both like the counterfeit industry as well as youth culture, because I mean, May specifically, she is of a younger generation and she doesn't seem to be as caged in by societal expectations. Like, was that something that you also discovered when you were, you know, researching for the book, is the culture of the younger generation in China?
Especially like the queer community in youth culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very, it's definitely a very vibrant culture, but I think it runs a lot. It's definitely a lot more beneath the surface just because of how society is. And I think a lot of the existing stigmas that are there. So I think it was really interesting to explore like how May, when she is able to leave China and go to the US for school, how she's able to embrace those parts of herself more. Because yeah, I think that's one of the really great parts of the US, which is that being like being able to, you know, fully express yourself. So I was actually really surprised by what I found about like Chinese communities, like queer communities, the fact that like they do exist, they usually congregate in like within these like online forums anonymously, but that they have found ways to communicate with each other and kind of form this shared identity.
I did love that when you were introduced to May and she had just come back from, I guess, she goes to Yale, right? And she's like, it's just the same old like rich people bullshit there too as it is here. But that was a pretty, pretty dope line.
Thanks. She has some great lines.
I thought it was really funny with like the counterfeit, like the underground counterfeit market, because I feel like that is something that a lot of Westerners like do not understand. Like, because I remember like my first time being exposed to the counterfeit market in Korea. And it was just like these guys who are on the sidewalk and they're like, hey, do you want some bags? And I'm like, what does that mean? And my aunt's just like, oh, come with me. And then they like, we just follow these men to like this warehouse, like that's just like hidden in the alleyways. I'm just like, what are they going to kill us? Like, why is it so secretive? And then you go in and it's just like bags galore. And you're like, oh my God, like how does this market work? And how are people able to like find it and just like get away with it? Was it interesting just like looking into the counterfeit market in China and just like learning more about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating. It's a huge market. And I feel like ever since I was really young going to China, I would see stuff about, or like I would go to markets and there'd be fake Gucci bags galore. And so I knew that like I wanted the counterfeit market to play a role in this because it's so, such a big part of like the identity of like Chinese culture in a lot of ways. Like there was an article, I forgot if it was the New York Times or it was through like, it was about this like subreddit called Rep Ladies. And that was where a lot of women were reviewing counterfeit bags. And what was really interesting in that article was how it talked about like how some of these counterfeit bags are so good that it just doesn't make sense to go buy the original. And even like wealthier people will like, their reasoning is, well, I can just get a pretty good replica for a portion of the price. And this way I can buy more, or like I can like cycle through more seasons. And so I thought that was really interesting. The fact that even within the counterfeit goods market, there's tiers to how good it can be. And yes, I've also had a similar experience of being in a market and being like in a mall and being led into like a dark alley and thinking, is this safe? And then like they open the door and it's like all these like bags, and then you see like who else is there and you're like, oh, interesting. So yeah, I think that's like such a fun part to write and think about, like what Michelangelo's store would look like.
Yeah. I love that her name was Michelangelo and you like referred to her as Michelangelo throughout the entire book pretty much.
I mean, that is basically her identity.
Yeah, I like that. You know, your three main characters are all women trying to fit into or exist in like proper society, but your two other heist members belong to the margins, right? They're part of underground cultures or like the quote unquote criminal underworld, I guess. Was it important for you to have that like diversity in your heist crew as well?
I actually did not think too much about that, but I knew that this like, when putting together this group of people, you want people with a variety of skills. And when you think of the three women at the core, like they kind of like followed, like up to that point, they were kind of following the path that society dictated for them. So I felt like there needed to be this outer pressure almost on them to kind of deviate from the norm. And I think those interactions with May and Michelangelo a lot of times are the key to getting them to think about what they actually want, or also like breaking down these assumptions that they had held for so long. So I think for that purpose, like, you know, these two were really important. And I've never heard it put like that, that they've like come in from the margins. I really like that framing of it. I haven't thought of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, because a high school isn't a high school unless there's some internal tensions in terms of like, is this person trustworthy? Is this person going to screw us? And I think bringing in someone who is literally doing crimes every day, it adds that little piece of tension that I really love in like a good heist story.
So we're winding down towards the end of our interview. And this is just like a silly question because the trio, Lulu, Jane, and Rena, they meet at the Hot Pot Palace to like plan out their heist. And I always thought that was like really funny because it's not... It's not really a place where you think, oh my God, they're talking about criminal activities over like delicious food.
That's why it's the perfect place.
I mean, if this was Korea, it would definitely be like a karaoke room or like a norebang room.
Oh, I could see that too.
Yeah. But like in terms of hot pot, everything sounded like so delicious to me, even as someone who like don't frequent hot pots and is like not familiar with Chinese hot pots, like all the different menus. So like, what do you usually order when you go to hot pot with your friends?
I really like, so I feel like I would categorize this into three categories: your veggies, your meat, and your carbs. And for me, I always go for lamb. That's my favorite meat, very thinly sliced lamb. And for veggies, I actually really like getting like kabocha squash. I think it tastes so good when it's been boiled in hot pot stew. And then for carbs, I'll get the widest noodle that they have.
I always forget that I have my squash in my hot pot and then it melts.
And then it gets all soup. Like murky.
Yeah. You mean not everything in the Hot Pot Palace in your book sounded appetizing, because they did run their specials that you highlighted every time they go, and they all sounded very sketch. Have you actually seen specials like this at hot pot places, or are you just having fun making stuff up?
I'm mostly having fun, but I know there's always like, I feel like when you go to dim sum or when you go to hot pot, there's always stuff where some people like it and then other people are like, no, I would never touch that. And that's kind of what I was going for. It's like, it was like maybe Lulu was into that, but Jane's like, no, absolutely not.
I mean, the boba hot pot did sound interesting, because I've had milk in my hot pot before as a broth, but
I think that was a thing in... Wasn't there like a boba? There might have been like a boba hot pot place in like New York or something. I could have sworn I saw a YouTube video about that.
Yeah. I haven't had hot pot since like it's been a couple months. I think like October, because I actually got COVID through a hot pot gathering with my friends.
Oh,
and
no.
All of us got COVID. It was so bad. So I'm like, oh man, I'm a little bit traumatized, so maybe I will try hot pot in like a couple weeks or so, you know. Yeah. Get over that fear.
Yeah, I think you need to face your fears head on.
I know. Yeah. I mean, like, we got COVID, but that hot pot was so good.
Then it was worth it.
Yeah, we're winding down, and we didn't even touch on, like, you know, you do have male characters in your book, and they're all also dealing with their own like struggle against societal values, and they could be the protagonists of their own story if they could. I really love the interaction between like Harv, Lulu's fiance, Vic the bad boy, and how Jane's husband, who is more than he seems.
The patriarchy hurts everyone, including the men.
Yeah, so I really appreciated that. You know, of course, we're rooting for all the badass women in your book, but at the same time, we're also rooting for the men, because they too are fighting their own personal battles against modern society and its expectations.
I'm glad you like them. I loved writing them, but yeah, I feel like most people just talk about the women. But I mean, the book is about the women.
I mean, they have their own struggles under the patriarchy. Everybody has like gender norms that they have to fight. And I didn't know that this was a thing with Chinese families naming their sons after like elite colleges, because Lulu's fiance is named Harvard. And I was like, Harvard? Like, oh my God, that's that's terrifying. Like,
yeah, I found that really funny. I mean, I don't know how long this trend lasted, but there were there are definitely kids out there that are named like Harvard or Princeton.
I mean, in Korean culture, it's like all like biblical names. So yeah, it's so whenever you come across someone who doesn't have a biblical name, you're like, wow, original. Your parents really loved you and really
very
tried.
Innovative.
Yeah. All right. So this podcast is airing the week that your book comes out. So as you're listening to our conversation, the book Women of Good Fortune is available at bookstores everywhere. Sophie, I know that you're probably in the middle of promoting this book, but I want to ask, since I enjoyed reading it so much, are you working on anything else right now?
I am working on a second book. I think it'll have some similar themes. It's also got women at the center of it. And I'm definitely going to be exploring more the idea of friendship and how it develops and how it changes. But I think that's all I can say for now about it.
Yeah. Well, very excited. Will there be another heist?
I think I've heisted out for now.
It's okay. We're looking forward to your future projects. Congratulations on your debut. And thank you so much for joining us on Books and Bulba. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
And that was Sophie Wan. Her debut novel, The Women of Good Fortune, is available now at bookstores everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Bulba online bookstore. So definitely check it out by going to booksandbulba.com and clicking on the bookshop link. As always, any purchases made on our online bookstore supports not only us at Books and Bulba, but also your local bookstores as well. So a win-win for everybody. So before we go, Rira, can you remind us what we are reading for the month of March?
Yeah, so for the month of March, we are reading Welcome to the Hyeonnam-dong Bookshop by Hwang Bo-rim, translated by Shanna Tan. And this is a new book. It came out, or at least it was translated and published in America, like late in February. And it's about a woman who is burnt out by her high-flying career, demanding marriage, and busy life in Seoul. And she quits all of that. She quits her job and divorces her husband to move to a small residential neighborhood outside of Seoul where she opens a bookstore. So she is living my dream right now. So I've heard great things about this book. It was picked as an indie's next pick. And I've heard a lot of great things from Korean readers. So I'm really excited to talk about it with you guys.
So yeah, if you're reading along with us, or if you've already finished the book, please let us know your thoughts on either our Discord server or our Goodreads forums. As always, we'd love to include your feedback in our discussions whenever possible. But yeah, that is our episode. Thanks again to Sophie Wan for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Bulba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandbulba, and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandbulba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Bulba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandbulba.com. Books and Bulba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Bill Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We've got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.